On Wednesday, Washington woke up to a new reality. A new Democratic majority in the House and a continued Republican majority in the Senate. But even with all this change, there's a familiar face taking center stage in Washington.
What is your level of confidence that you'll be the Speaker of the House?
Total.
100%?
100%, yeah.
Nancy Pelosi. That's her on CNN. The first woman Speaker of the House is positioning herself to regain the speakership, more than a decade after she first secured the job.
I accept this gavel in the spirit of partnership, not partisanship.
Tonight, I have the high privilege as the first president to begin the State of the Union message with these words, Madam Speaker.
During her previous tenure, Democrats passed the Affordable Care Act and legislation to stop a bleeding economy during the housing crisis. Even the president had nice things to say about her the other day.
I give her a lot of credit. She works very hard, and she's worked long and hard. I give her a great deal of credit for what she's done and what she's accomplished.
But this time around, not everyone sold on another Speaker Pelosi. Almost two dozen Democrats have, at some point, said they won't support her as Speaker. Now, some of that reticence has to do with the fact that she's been a constant villain in Republican campaign ads.
Well, Democrat leader Nancy Pelosi and her liberal allies spent over $6 million
joining Hillary Clinton and Nancy Pelosi supporting a national energy tax.
If McCall loses again, hello, Nancy.
So is Nancy Pelosi really the best person to take Democrats out of the wilderness and into 2020?
I didn't ask anybody for support because I was too busy winning an election.
This is Politics with Amy Walter from The Takeaway.
I think that this particular moment in time is not a time where you need on-the-job training. You need somebody who's been to the circus before.
That's Dr. John Lawrence, who was Nancy Pelosi's chief of staff from 2005 to 2013. He's currently visiting professor at the University of California Washington Center, and he's author of the new book, The Class of 74, Congress After Watergate and the Roots of Partisanship.
You need somebody who's going to step into the role of speaker, who knows how to manage the caucus, who knows how to listen to members and to address the diverse needs of people in the caucus. But most importantly, you're also going to need somebody who stands up for the institutional interests of the House of Representatives. And that's Nancy Pelosi. She has a proven record. Independent congressional observers call her the most successful speaker in the last 75 years. You have a large infusion of women coming into Congress. It's just inconceivable to me that Democrats would agree to unilateral disarmament and install as a speaker someone who has no experience in any of those crucial areas of legislative and political management.
And yet, there were a number of Democratic candidates, and there are current Democratic incumbents who've said, I absolutely cannot vote for Nancy Pelosi. So if she is as effective and as important as you laid out, why is she having trouble with a significant number of Democrats coming on board?
I think it's very simple. The Republican Party has spent millions, tens of millions of dollars over the last decade vilifying her. And the Democrats should not allow the Republican opposition to choose their leaders by vilifying an effective leader. And I think people should also understand, it's not as though if someone else were installed as the speaker, the Republican opposition would be benevolent towards them. Think of what they did to Barack Obama. You go after the political leadership. I understand the people who are running in marginal districts, and many of the people that we were elected on Tuesday are in marginal districts, could not stand up in the course of that kind of onslaught to the direct question. But I think now that they're going to be members of Congress, they're going to come into the institution, they're going to see how their personal best interest and the caucus's best interest and the Congress's best interests are served. I think they're going to take a second look at that decision and find a way to support Mrs. Pelosi.
Well, you actually just recently wrote a book about the class of members that came in, the so-called Watergate babies. They came in 1974, right after Richard Nixon left office. There are a bunch of folks, me included, who have compared this incoming class to that Watergate baby class. They're new to politics. They're very young. Many of them have run as reformers, outsiders. So tell me how those folks who are running, not only did they say, we can't vote for Nancy Pelosi, or we need new leadership. How do they come into this Congress and work with someone who is part of the establishment and has represented, for good or bad, the establishment in Washington for all these years?
I think that their frustration is not with an individual. It's with a system that is not responsive to the demands of the American people, whether that's on affordability of education or protecting health care, a whole litany of issues. And now that the Democrats are in the majority, they're going to have an opportunity to act on those. Whether or not the Republican majority Senate responds or whether or not the president vetoes, we'll have to see those developments as they occur, you know, one crisis at a time. But I think that the frustration here is not with an individual or with the leadership, as it was, for example, in 1974 that I wrote my book about. The problem there was that you had an infusion of young progressive people, and what they confronted were caucus chairmen and leaders, particularly committee chairmen, who refused to allow legislation to proceed, even if it had a majority support in the Democratic caucus. You're not going to have that problem this time. The leadership, the committee chairmen, are very interested in moving the kind of legislation that these freshmen said they were going to support when they ran for office. And I think that the first step for them is going to be get on the committees that they want to be on in order to serve their constituents and in order to advance the policies on which they ran. And you're going to find, certainly Mrs. Pelosi, she is extremely skillful at putting people into committee slots where they can be most effective.
So realistically, what can a speaker do when the Senate is controlled by Republicans and the White House obviously controlled by Republicans? What can he really do?
Well, there are two major areas of responsibility. One is oversight, and that is a crucial component of the congressional responsibility. I think you'll be seeing now a lot more use of oversight. I don't mean irresponsible oversight. I don't think people are going to be rushing to issue subpoenas, but there will be a calling to account, and that is proper and responsible. I think the other part is obviously legislation.
You don't think, though, that Democrats are going to use the subpoena power for more political purposes? That's certainly the line that the president, Republicans have been using, that they're going to be using their subpoena power to personally go after the president, whether it's getting his tax records or going after his business dealings. You think they're going to stay focused just on the oversight of the government itself?
Well, I think the administration, the president, has gotten very used to nobody asking them very tough questions. I don't think anybody cares about Donald Trump's tax returns from the standpoint of his payment of taxes. I think they care about whether or not he's manipulating his policy decisions in order to benefit himself personally or financially. If necessary, I think they will use subpoenas, of course, because the Congress is a co-equal branch of government. It has every right in the world to ask those questions. And hopefully the executive branch, the president and other cabinet officials who will be called down to testify for the first time to account for their decisions will comply, and subpoenas aren't necessary. Remember, subpoenas are not the first line of defense. Subpoenas are used when people refuse to cooperate with the constitutional requirement that they respond to congressional inquiries.
John, you made the case for why Leader Pelosi should be the speaker, but does she have the votes to get to be speaker?
Mrs. Pelosi is the best vote counter I've ever seen in almost 40 years of working for the Congress. I think that she will spend whatever time is necessary talking to both current members and incoming members. She will explain her case, make her case. I have no doubt whatsoever that when the tally is taken, that she will comfortably be elected speaker by the Democratic caucus.
John Lawrence, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Amy.
John Lawrence served as chief of staff for Nancy Pelosi from 2005 to 2013. So now our reality check. First, can Nancy Pelosi win election as speaker? And if so, what is her strategy for the Democrats? There are no two better folks to help me answer those questions than Susan Glasser, staff writer for The New Yorker, and Paul Kane, senior congressional correspondent and columnist for The Washington Post. Welcome to you both.
Thanks.
Hey there, Amy.
So, Paul, I'm going to start with you. Does she have the votes?
Many, many years ago, Trent Lott, when he was Senate Majority Leader, said to me something, "You don't have the votes until you have the vote." So the answer is no, she doesn't have the votes right now, but she is working meticulously to get them. And for all the reasons, I talked to John Tuesday evening and Tuesday night, so it was great to hear his voice again. His points are spot on, but you still have to go get the votes, and she's trying to do that right now.
There's a lot of talk about people not voting for Pelosi, but there's no talk about if not Pelosi, then who? So,
yeah,
it seems like a big challenge in beating Nancy Pelosi is having, oh, I don't know, someone to actually vote for if it's not her.
That is the ultimate problem with this whole effort. The other Trent Lott-ism that I learned early on was you can't beat someone with no one. You have to have someone. And so far, this whole effort is just so gripped around the idea that, hey, she's not great. She always lost these elections. And, you know, we'll just deny her the speakership. And then someone will miraculously just appear and become speaker. And that just doesn't work that way.
Susan, what's your sense of what is really behind the Democratic opposition to Pelosi? Those members who ran campaign ads saying, don't worry, I'm not going to vote for Nancy Pelosi, or incumbent members who won't vote for her?
Well, look, I think one point that we've already talked about a little bit today is the question of whether she's been subject to a national campaign of vilification. It is interesting that they sought to sort of make her the Hillary Clinton of this election cycle, and that's part of it. They made it much harder for Democrats running in Republican-leaning districts to support her openly. And I think if you look at, I believe Politico has something like 10 incoming members who've said that they won't vote for her on the floor, and all of those essentially are in districts where the politics of that are very impossible. So that's a key reason. And the fact that in a change election, do you really want to pick the same leadership team that you've had for a decade?
Well, and how much of it do you think this is about her age and her gender versus her policy positions?
I think it has always been more about losing. They lost four straight races, 2010, 12, 14, 16, and that was the frustration. They screwed up oftentimes her opponents, sometimes by just making it sound like it was just about her age.
Susan, in your New Yorker piece, you wrote this week that Washington will get worse, not better, as a result of Tuesday's results. Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, I was already typing that before President Trump's now famous press conference. And, you know, I think that gave us on full display the first 24 hours after the election results told you a lot about how this is a president who, once again, is sort of blowing up the script. Generally speaking, we've had many presidents in modern times who've suffered a rebuke by the voters 2 years into their term. President Bush had his thumping. President Obama had his shellacking. They both responded by at least rhetorically talking about unity and finding ways to work more with the other party that now was in more control of Congress. You haven't seen that approach, I would say, from President Trump, but, you know, he's taken the move of not only firing his attorney general, which, of course, we've had almost 2 years of preview of that, but putting in his place someone who's facing escalating concerns from Democrats and, interestingly, conservative legal scholars who believe the appointment of this acting attorney general may actually be unconstitutional. You have the confrontation with the press escalating with the removal of CNN correspondent Jim Acosta's credentials. And in generally speaking, you have Trump's unwillingness essentially to accept the results of the election as any kind of a rebuke for him and his party.
But Paul, they have infrastructure, right? Don't they have infrastructure? They're going to work together to like build roads, and they're going to do health care and all of that. Come on. Is that not going to happen?
Look, there are some modest areas where they could potentially work together. And I think left to their own devices, Nancy Pelosi, when she goes on the full charm offensive, she can be great. And I think she could get Trump himself to agree to certain things. and infrastructure is one of them. But then she'll leave the White House and he'll have Mick Mulvaney, Stephen Miller, and Mike Pence standing around saying, no, you can't agree to that. And then he'll just go back and sit down at his desk and break out his phone and start typing out, like, you know, wacky Nancy, bad idea, I disagree. I think that's probably where we're headed for most of the next 2 years.
Susan, do you agree that the White House strategy is to try to exploit these divisions within the Democratic Party or the polarization? Or do they want to actually rack up some wins that they can talk about in 2020 as, you know, here we got stuff done?
Well, I think once again, you're probably going to see a divergence to a certain extent in the strategy of Republican elected officials on Capitol Hill and elsewhere and the strategy of the president, who is much less interested, as you know, in legislating and really essentially is a permanent campaigner. And you saw that in how different he was over the last 6 weeks of the campaign, out on the campaign trail, doing something like 30 rallies in 60 days. I anticipate that Trump will continue to be basically in campaign mode all the way from now through 2020. And I think that he's much less interested in the details of legislating and policy to begin with. And he seems to have little patience for the very different craft of making things happen here in Washington. He just wants to run against Washington in a permanent way. You know, it was fascinating, right, that during this last campaign, Republicans, when they passed the tax cut, thought that would be the centerpiece of their campaign. And the economy, which has continued to do quite well under Trump, any other president would have just talked about that over and over and over again ad nauseum. That was not Donald Trump's way, as you know. I listened to many of his rallies. He would often talk about the tax cut close to 1 hour into his speech. What he wanted to talk about was immigration and other divisive cultural issues. So I expect that not only to continue, but actually to escalate as he faces bigger potential legal and political troubles here in Washington.
Paul, if Nancy Pelosi is indeed elected speaker, and quite frankly, even if she's not, if there's whoever the Democratic speaker is, they're going to have a big, very diverse caucus with some folks there who really do want to see Trump taken to task, some want to impeach him immediately. And then you have many of these new members from swing districts. They ran as problem solvers. They're in very competitive districts. How to balance those two seems like a significant challenge.
I believe that half of the 31 or so pickups, you know, they're still counting votes. I think half of the districts where they picked up seats are Trump districts, places where he won in 2016, and the other half being Hillary districts. That's like a perfect 50-50 snapshot of America, of Democrats, of Republicans, of everything. And if that's what you're looking at going into 2020, they're going to have twice as many seats that are Trump districts as they are Hillary districts. That tells you, like, this is a majority that is pretty thin. There's not a big foundation for it. And they have to be careful. It is going to take serious balancing. And Pelosi did this 12 years ago. When I talked to John on Tuesday, he made the point. In 2007, yeah, they wanted to go straight to impeachment.
And Susan, I'm wondering, from what you're hearing and reporting, and just from watching this White House over the last 2 years, do you think that the president and those around him fully appreciate what it means to have Democrats in control of the House? What it will mean for their own political futures?
Short answer, no. Slightly longer answer, I think what's going to happen now is it's going to bring into even sharper contrast the extent to which this White House is organized so much around President Trump and in such an unconventional way that its weaknesses in dealing with another branch of government, which they haven't had to do, are going to be very apparent. For example, this immediate controversy over the hiring of the acting attorney general, who appears, A, not to have been vetted at all. Immediately controversial stories like one in the Washington Post about his service on the board of a company accused of fraud and ripping people off in Florida, things like that. In any other White House, that just would be malpractice, number one. Number two, doesn't seem to have the legal competence in place. You know, there's a serious issue raised by conservative legal scholars about whether his appointment is constitutional. Remember, the White House counsel just left, was forced out very ignominiously by President Trump. His replacement doesn't have the same kind of experience. The White House counsel's office would really need to staff up. You're going to have even more people leaving the White House, and it's going to be very hard to recruit people of high caliber who are able to go toe-to-toe with the best legal minds in the Democratic Party. And so that's one just very structural reason why I think it's going to be a lot of chaos that they haven't anticipated.
And Paul, one last thing. We didn't get to talk about the Republican leadership fights, but I'm wondering if you think that there is a possibility that Jim Jordan, who, of course, is the leader of the Tea Party or the Freedom Caucus, the sort of rebel wing, he's thrown his hat in the ring to be the minority leader. Do you think that there is a possibility that he could be leading Republicans instead of Kevin McCarthy, who is the current majority leader?
There is only one path to Jim Jordan becoming the Republican leader, and it is simply Donald Trump deciding one day that I really want Jim Jordan to be my leader, and I'm going to fire off 7 or 8 tweets telling those Republicans to pick Jim Jordan. Otherwise, absent that, if this goes to a simple head-to-head race, Jim Jordan might not get 25 votes out of the 190 or 95.
He hasn't made a lot of friends among his colleagues.
It's not just that he hasn't made a lot of friends. He has actively tried not to make friends. right down to the point where he wouldn't go out and campaign for any of his fellow Republicans. He didn't do anything. He is not a well-liked person, and here's what's going to happen. The Republicans did not used to release their vote tallies in leadership races. Boehner was such a softy that he felt like they shouldn't release the vote tallies, didn't want to embarrass people. Well, they changed that rule a few years ago. Jim Jordan is not likely to actually stand for this election, because if he does, he is going to lose in such embarrassing fashion that no one can take him seriously anymore. So instead, he is going to try to negotiate an exit strategy by which he gets the ranking member slot of the Oversight Committee. And then he bows out and endorses Kevin McCarthy in some sort of act of unity. He can't stand for this election and have the results come out that the result is 175-18. It is a humiliating thing among members of Congress. You never get taken seriously again if you have that few of votes.
Right. Paul Kane, senior congressional correspondent and columnist for The Washington Post, and Susan Glasser is a staff writer for The New Yorker. Thanks so much, you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Support for this podcast comes from Babbel. People around the world are learning new languages with the Babbel Language Learning app. And you can too. Learn Spanish, French, Italian, German, Russian, Swedish, and more with Babbel's 10 to 15 minute lessons. Babbel users say they're amazed at how fast they learned and that they are confident in speaking their new language. Start learning a new language today. Just go to Babbel.com and use offer code TAKEAWAY to get 50% off your first 3 months. That's Babbel, BABBEL.com, offer code TAKEAWAY for 50% off your first 3 months.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Amy Walter. Over the next few weeks, between now and the start of the next Congress, we're going to be profiling members of the incoming class. Today we hear from Angie Craig, a Democrat who defeated Republican Representative Jason Lewis in Minnesota's 2nd District. It was an important pickup for Democrats in a swing district that President Trump won by just 1 point in 2016. Craig also joins the group of firsts from Tuesday night. In her case, she'll be the first openly LGBTQ person elected from Minnesota, something that might not have been possible just a few years ago in a swing Midwestern suburb.
You know, this is my second run, and I felt like the first time, it wasn't that I was hiding it, but I wasn't as open about it. And you know, more than anything, voters want authenticity these days. And the second run, you know, I cut an ad that said, you know, my wife Cheryl and I have four sons. Those were the first words. And it's almost like I just put it out there. And when I put it out there, just as any other candidate would talk about their family, people were like, oh, okay. And so it really wasn't a deal. And it's fascinating. I mean, none of the local media coverage is even mentioned that I happen to be a lesbian.
During the campaign, a lot of ads were run against you saying you were going to be a Pelosi clone and follow a liberal playbook. When you go to Washington, when you're starting your time there, do you feel like you need to prove your independence from her?
You know, I think I just need to prove that I'm looking out for Minnesota. You know, the Democrats are going to elect a speaker. They're going to elect a leader. And, you know, I'm going to vote for a Democrat for those positions in every single one. What I have already said to a number of folks is I'd like to see more people in leadership from the Midwest. You know, Sherry Bustos has become a friend and a mentor, and I think that she ought to be in leadership in the next Congress. And, you know, I'm going to be looking for who's prioritizing bringing down the cost of healthcare. I'm going to be looking for who's prioritizing infrastructure investment. The second congressional district had John Klein for a very long time, 20 years. And, you know, we've got a lot of infrastructure needs here that would create economic opportunity. So it's more to me about what priorities are those leaders going to have. And I've said, like a number of the freshman class coming in, that, you know, I'd love to see some transparency around super PAC money. You know, I don't have any illusions that we're going to overturn Citizens United and have a constitutional amendment, although I would support that. It's highly unlikely, as you know. But I certainly would support additional transparency around funding of super PACs, and I think it's critical to democracy.
Now, you didn't talk a lot about Donald Trump in your ads, at least the ones that I saw. Was that on purpose?
You know, I didn't talk a lot about Jason Lewis either, which is really different from my 2016 race. Where Trump is concerned, where the administration is concerned, when someone would bring him up in my own party or otherwise, you know, the way I talk about it is just, look, if, you know, if there's a good idea that I agree with, I'll support it. Not going to oppose someone or something for the sake of doing so. But if it's important to stand up to the administration based on its policies, I'll do that too. And, you know, an interesting thing, we cut 10 positive ads this cycle, 10. And we thought the path to victory would be standing out by talking about what we're going to run for. I gave voters a little bit more visibility into who I am, not only as a candidate and professionally, but as a person by showing them my wife and our four sons on a number of occasions, and told voters in one ad about growing up for a portion of my own childhood without health insurance. I talked about my mom being a single mom and my grandmother going to work in a factory to help support us. And I did have to open myself up to voters. And the truth is, I decided when I ran again, I was, you know, bringing the whole deal this time.
How often did the issue of Russia, the Mueller investigation, the Jeff Sessions fight come up when you were talking to voters?
Hardly at all. It's interesting because after the 2016 election, I made a point to going to labor picnics all summer. In fact, I didn't even file to run until October because I needed to sit down. You know, 40 to 50% of people who traditionally were Obama labor supporters had voted for the president. And, you know, I didn't go as a candidate. I went as a person and truly wanted to understand why they voted for Trump. And when I would have a hamburger and a beer with folks, what they would say is, look, this country screwed up. You know, I mean, I'm getting 1% pay raises every year, and it's not even covering the cost of my, you know, jacked up health care. We're not better off than we were, even though Democrats in 2016 had pointed to all kinds of economic indicators that were, you know, we should all feel like they were better, but people weren't feeling it. And I think Donald Trump tapped into that. So when I ran for Congress this time, what people talked to me about was health care. Almost every conversation started with what's going on with the cost of health care to their family. Mm. And so we just, you know, that's what people wanted to talk about.
Though it is likely that maybe in the next, who knows how many days or weeks, that there will actually be a report issued. And now you're no longer just a candidate, you're actually going to be a member of Congress when this is happening. So tell me how you are going to address some of these things, like the Mueller report, like the fact that the president has dismissed Sessions and replaced him with a person who has been somewhat critical of the Mueller investigation.
Well, I keep holding out hope that folks from both sides of the aisle will continue to step up and not only protect the investigation, but, you know, once we actually have the investigation and see the results of that, whatever it says has to be taken seriously. The timing of Jeff Sessions' firing, you know, the day after the midterm elections, that's what concerns me the most.
Yeah, what concerns you about that?
Well, this should be a matter of national security, not petty politics. And of course, the replacement has openly criticized the Mueller investigation and can now block the release of information from the investigation. I mean, to me, that's a major setback for transparency and accountability.
And so what should Democrats do about that?
Well, I think we're going to have to fight it. And to me, that's not fighting the administration. That's fighting for democracy. There has been an ongoing investigation for 2 years about potential foreign interference in a United States election. That principle of democracy takes precedent for me over any political concerns. And I sure hope that there are Republicans who at one time, like Lindsey Graham, who had been outspoken about the need to protect the Mueller investigation. I hope they step up and honor their word over the coming
weeks. So that would be the first thing to do is legislation protecting the special counsel.
That's right.
And if that doesn't work or if that doesn't occur, then what role do you think that Democrats' oversight should play in all of this?
Well, you know, I'm a freshman member of Congress. I'm sure that leadership will be having a long conversation about that. But, you know, we have a responsibility first and foremost to the country. We need to see what the Mueller investigation turns up.
And do you think they should make the report public then?
Absolutely. Yeah, the American people deserve to know what happened in the 2016 election. It doesn't matter who wins or loses that election. And in terms of, you know, if this were the other side of the aisle and we had won and there was interference in the U.S. election, I would want to know how that unfolded to help inform how do we prevent that from ever happening again.
Well, Angie Craig, thank you so much for joining us.
It's an honor and a pleasure, and I look forward to talking to you here as a member of Congress.
Angie Craig is the Congresswoman-elect from Minnesota's 2nd Congressional District. Part of this week's recalibration in Washington was the notion that the president might pursue a more unifying approach.
Hopefully we can all work together next year to continue delivering for the American people, including on economic growth, infrastructure, trade, lowering the cost of prescription drugs. These are some of the things that the Democrats do want to work on.
But that dissolved quickly on Wednesday during President Trump's press briefing.
Mr. President.
I'll tell you what, CNN should be ashamed of itself having you working for them. You are a rude, terrible person. You shouldn't be working for CNN. Go ahead.
I think that's unfair.
You're a very rude person. The way you treat Sarah Huckabee is horrible. And the way you treat other people are horrible. You shouldn't treat people that way.
Hours after that exchange between the president and CNN White House correspondent Jim Acosta, the administration revoked Acosta's press credentials.
I am in front of the White House. A Secret Service officer is asking for my hard pass. Obviously, no hard feelings to the officer, but I am now giving my hard pass to the Secret Service.
In defense of their decision, the administration circled the doctored video of the exchange and Acosta's interaction with a White House intern, first shared by the far-right website InfoWars. Olivier Knox is the president of the White House Correspondents Association and the chief D.C. correspondent for SiriusXM. And while his job typically focuses on logistical matters, weeks like this demand something much different.
When things collapse spectacularly, I'm called upon to speak on behalf of the roughly 600 members of the association, sometimes in conflict with the White House. This is the third time that I've had to put out a statement criticizing a White House decision. I wasn't even a week on the job when the White House barred a CNN reporter from basically a public event at the White House in retaliation for her questions in the Oval Office. I put out a statement when the president celebrated a congressman's criminal assault on a reporter. And then I put out a statement describing the decision to strip a CNN correspondent of his Secret Service pass to the White House grounds in retaliation for his actions at a press conference. Absolutely true. Sometimes I'm not just discussing motorcades and Wi-Fi. Sometimes I'm called upon to defend the ability of a free press to cover the most powerful institution in American political life.
It's now been 2 years of covering this president. What have you figured out about working with this president? And what do you think you and your colleagues need to do or maybe need to do better for the next 2 years?
One thing I've learned is that he's extremely comfortable being his own press secretary, communications director, and spokesman. So you've seen him come out in the last month or so and take hundreds of questions from reporters. I can't think of a reporter who thinks that he should take fewer. I think it's great that he's coming out, taking questions from as he's off to the helicopter, taking questions at a press conference, taking questions when he's meeting with people either in the Oval Office or the cabinet room. He's been increasingly accessible in that sense. The other thing is, for all the really ugly language that he directs in our direction, he does crave news coverage. He's very sensitive to it. He's been known to scold aides if, you know, a camera angle is off or if the sound is not good on something else. In terms of what we need to do, I mean, there are a couple aspects of this. One of them is, I'm old enough now, Amy, that people actually ask me for advice, which is weird. But when they ask me how to cover the White House, my answer is always the best way to cover the White House is not to cover the White House. It's to reach out to people in Congress, the Pentagon, the State Department, the other agencies, foreign embassies, former officials, think tankers, etc. Basically, you're looking for overlap of information without overlap in interest in keeping that information secret. And so that's the best way to cover, I think, almost any White House.
The president, you know, when you were talking about how much he enjoys the press, even as he's attacking the press, how do you balance that? You obviously both need each other. He wants the coverage. You all want the eyeballs and the clicks. How do you work in that environment to make sure that you're not just simply sort of falling into what seems like a game of one-upmanship?
Well, let me start by saying I do appreciate that you highlighted the business part of the press, the eyeballs and the clicks. But I'll tell you that everybody I know in the White House press corps feels more of a duty to readers and listeners and viewers and actually, you know, chronicling a presidency for our fellow citizens and for the world. So there is a mission component to what we do. In terms of not falling into what people are describing as traps, you know, we are describing us as the White House press corps gives sort of this false sense of that we are sort of all one, sort of an amalgam of people. We lose our individuality here. But in fact, editorial decisions get made by individual outlets. They don't get made by me. And so I make my own decisions. I make decisions for SiriusXM. But, you know, if CNN wants to cover something else or if the Associated Press wants to cover something else or whatever, then that's up to those individual outlets.
Do you think that the president thinks he's at war with you, even if you don't think you're at war with him?
They've made a very conscious decision to elevate us as enemies. Very clear. It's a very clear political decision. You know, he likes to have an opponent. He thrived on the Republican primary debate stage, having opponents and belittling them. He thrived having an opponent in Hillary Clinton. And he has now chosen to effectively go to war with us very publicly. You know, he encourages his supporters at rallies to jeer and howl and call us fake news. I'll tell you, you know, in late 2000, Amy, I was attacked by a supporter of Al Gore who threw my laptop in the beach at an event in Florida. In 2004, a Kerry supporter threw some batteries at me. In 2004, again, a supporter of George W. Bush spat on me. And I still divide my career into pre and post February of 2017, because that's when the president called us the enemies of the people. I was driving my son somewhere a couple days later, and he burst into tears, and I asked him what was wrong, and he asked me whether Donald Trump was going to put me in prison. That's very new. That's a very new feeling. It's as a Frenchman, I sort of recognize the irony that the president is wielding a phrase that was developed during the French Revolution, but it's obviously very, very different.
Do you worry, Olivier, that what happened with Jim Acosta, there's just, it's one reporter, one hard pass, but that this is going to be ratcheted up over the next couple of years, that more reporters will be banned or specific critics of the president will no longer be able to access the White House?
I can tell you that the concern from White House Correspondents Association members who have emailed me and called me and texted me, that's the number one concern, that this is a precedent-setting moment. Obviously, that's one of my concerns as well, absolutely, that this not be a precedent-setting moment. I mean, to be clear, I think this was a disproportionate response, and I've publicly urged the White House to reverse course. But of course, that's a concern.
Olivier Knox is the president of the White House Correspondents Association and the chief D.C. correspondent for SiriusXM. The midterm elections may be over, but are we more polarized today, after the midterms, than we were a week ago? And what does it all mean for the road to 2020? I'm joined now by two veteran politicos, Doug Sosnick and Sarah Fagan. Doug was a senior advisor to President Bill Clinton, and Sarah is former political director for President George W. Bush. Doug and Sarah, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Amy.
Great to be here. Thank you, Amy.
I'm really happy to have you. So, Doug, let me start with you. You and Sarah wrote together an op-ed for Politico. And in your opening comments, you note that 2018 was the sixth change election of the last seven elections. What is America trying to say to us?
Well, what America is trying to do is come to terms with, I think, with the biggest transition that we're going through as a country since the Industrial Revolution. And our institutions are incapable of dealing with these changes. And so, for the most part, since the beginning of the last decade, middle of the last decade, voters have been largely voting against who's ever in power rather than voting for someone, because they feel like, regardless of political party, that the system is not working for them. So as we sort through this transition period, I suspect we're going to continue to see these series of change elections because the large majority of people in this country feel like their government is not working for them.
How much of it, though, Sarah, is driven by the way that campaigns are run, which is the motivating factor in these past few elections hasn't been, hey, isn't it great all the work that party in power has been able to do, but the energy really is around the anger on the party in power, and getting your voters to turn out to support your party is much harder than getting your voters out to vote against the opposite party.
It is an angry electorate. And even though people tend to vote for one party when they go to the polls, they're very fickle. And, you know, they're fickle in their turnout patterns. Do they show up to support these candidates? You know, effectively what's happening is every 2 years we dump one party from at least one chamber of the Congress and switch out a few governors and so forth. I think there's another factor at play here, which is that midterms are very different than presidential elections in terms of the types of voters that turn out. One of the reasons Democrats had a very good night on Tuesday is they did do a good job of turning out some presidential, typical presidential voters, and, you know, younger voters, minorities, women, college-educated women, single women, they turned them out at a slightly higher percentage relative to which you would expect in a presidential. And then they got a higher share of college-educated women than typically Democrats do. But there's nothing to say that that group of women won't vote Republican again in the future. But right now, they are voting Democratic.
I totally take Sarah's point, and I absolutely agree that midterms are not predictive of the next presidential election. But what can we learn from the 2018 election about what the 2020 map for the battleground states will look like?
Well, I think what we learned was that 2016, in terms of voting behavior and patterns, remember, as Hillary Clinton said, she carried the areas, the counties she carried in America represented 2/3 of the GDP growth in our country. But the same token, 84% of the counties in America voted for Trump in 2016. And so I think if you learned anything from 2018, it was that the trends that we saw in 2016 are going to be actually hardened and even more prevalent going forward in what is commonly referred to now as tribal politics. And my own view on this was that going back now, beginning almost 50 years ago in the beginning of the 1970s, and there's been an economic decline of the middle class in our country, and it was, of course, obviously exacerbated by the economic crises of the last decade. So our problems, our divisions in our country right now, I think while they're rooted in economics, it's now become a cultural thing, and we're not only voting more tribal, but we're also beginning to live in communities that are more tribal, so people are living around people like themselves. And that's why on Tuesday night, Democrats picked up congressional seats now in some of the reddest states like South Carolina and Georgia and Oklahoma and Kansas and Iowa, because even within these red states, you've got these blue enclaves now of people that are living around people like themselves. And so I think that the one thing we can learn, I believe, about what 2018 means for 2020 is that the trends that began surfacing in 2016 are going to be even more prevalent in 2 years.
And Sarah, so does this mean that in order to win in 2020, a candidate is not going to be as concerned with winning over converts as they are with turning out the faithful?
Well, I think it's still going to be both, just because you have such a higher turnout and you tend to get more people who are disconnected to politics to actually show up in a presidential year than a midterm. But I do think that is a key part of this for both parties, is they've got to turn out their bases, and they've got to have a message that convinces enough of those small, narrow, you know, sort of 7 or 8% of the country that sort of typically is truly undecided to convert to their side. Who Democrats nominate, though, in 2020 will matter a lot. The country is still center-right. It's less center-right than it was. I think it still leans to the right. And so if Democrats nominate somebody who is far to the left, somebody out of the mold of an Elizabeth Warren, I think Donald Trump's chances of being reelected are much higher. I think the other factor, which we haven't spoken about here, is the economy. Still in this country, even with our tribal politics, the economy matters very significantly. We saw it Tuesday night. Democrats had a good night, but they won fewer House seats in part because I think there were some economic headwinds helping Republicans. That will be true in the presidential race even more so.
I think that there's probably around 30% that are for Trump no matter what, and they're probably around 40%, maybe even 45%, somewhere in there, that are against Trump no matter what. That still leaves around 25, 30, even maybe 35% of the public that is in neither camp. And so I think that it's going to be critical on both sides that there's an effort to turn out your people. But I think you absolutely need to have a persuasion campaign. And for that 25 to 30% of the electorate, whatever that number is, they're not fighting the holy war. They're just thinking about their lives. And so that's where the economy really does matter and other issues. And so I think the notion that you just have a base strategy in this political environment is a big mistake.
Doug Sosnick, Sarah Fagan, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And here's one final thought from me. Think of Democratic leaders in the House and President Trump as jugglers. Leader Pelosi and Democrats are trying to keep multiple balls in the air. A restive liberal wing that wants to investigate, maybe even impeach the president. A new class of freshman Democrats who sit in swing districts and want to avoid political fights with Trump. And a legislative agenda that will require compromise with the GOP-held Senate and the White House. Meanwhile, Trump's got his own juggling act to keep up. He wants to exploit the divides within the Democratic Party while also promoting himself as a dealmaker. And of course, he wants to protect himself from the inevitable investigations into his administration. But now imagine that instead of juggling tennis balls, they're actually juggling bottles of nitroglycerin. Just one slip of the hand and boom, you've got a big explosion. In other words, if you thought the last 2 years were fraught, well, get ready for even more drama and unpredictability in 2019. You can always find us on Facebook, leave a comment there, or send us a tweet. I'm at Amy E. Walter, and the show is At The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Amy Walter, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Progressive Insurance, offering its Home Quote Explorer, designed to provide information about available home insurance options in one place. More information at progressive.com.